can't tell if the chemistry's good by looking at it. It wasn't clear yesterday. For the last time, the saltwater pool is a chlorine pool.
This is the Talking Pools Podcast with pool pros from every region in the country. If it happens in a pool, you'll hear about it here. Everything from tips and hacks to the latest tricks and trends. Breaking news, we lay it on the line. We tell it like it is because we think you deserve to know.
Welcome back. We now join the shocking conclusion to Pool Pros Gone Wired with Dan Lentz.
I'm trying this really good beer tonight. Grevensteiner. Fantastic sales rep of mine. Christmas present was beer of the month. He knows me well. So cheers to everyone out there as I sample some of this month's beer, Grevensteiner. I'm guessing it's out of Germany. There's some paperwork it came with. I'll have to research that and see what it is exactly. But it's delicious. So at any rate, wire size, breaker size, hopefully you understand what's going on there. We talked last week about, since I'm mentioning breakers again, how GFIs are required on certain pool components, most notably the pump. Any pump motor today has to have a GFI breaker supplying power to it. There is no grandfathering of that. If it doesn't have a GFI, and you go out and put a new motor on it or put a new pump in that installation, you need to be able to have a GFI installed. Instruct the homeowner. They need to get a licensed electrician to install that GFI. And I would argue at that point, they need to have that electrician finish wiring the pump up. So there's no chance of them operating that pump without a GFI and potentially having some sort of a short in the system, allow power to get in the water and cause harm that way. Underwater pool lights are another big one. If it's more than 15 volts, the light has to be on a GFI. If it's less than 15, it's not required, but we always do it. I don't like seeing even 12 volt lights that are not GFI protected. It's a relatively inexpensive additional layer of protection, and we're at All Seasons, we're all about the layering of everything. Layer the protection, layer the prevention, and layer the knowledge, and everything goes smoothly when you do that. So GFIs are important as well. Something else that's important in my mind is using the right wire color, the casing on the wire, for the right application. And this is done so often in a really crappy way because we're out there in the field. We don't have we've got a hunk of wire on the truck. It's not really the right color for the application, but it's what we're going to use because it's what we've got. All of our technicians carry various colors of electrical tape for the purpose of just indicating at the end of that wire if it is something different, which is something that's perfectly fine to do, but most everybody understands that a black wire is hot, commonly in residential, carrying 115 volts. A white wire is neutral, and a green wire is ground. That's pretty standard. But there are a lot of other wire colors out there. Some of the most common ones are red, blue, yellow, gray. And there are other, you get into purple and, all this other kind of stuff, orange. But in common practice with electricity, a black wire is a hot wire carrying 115 volts.
Join the Council for the Model Aquatic Health Code, aka CMAC. CMAC is a member-driven organization that keeps the Model Aquatic Health Code sustainable, current, and complete. Your expertise is needed. Learn more at cmahc.org. That's cmahc.org.
A red wire is also a hot wire, also carrying 115 volts. It can be, the voltage can be more, especially if you're in a four-phase kind of a thing, but it's definitely a hot wire. Not uncommon to find a different color wire, specifically white, that has some electrical tape around the very end of it before it's bared and connected know, so a white wire with a wrap of red or a wrap of black at the end is an indication that, hey, and what I had, all I had was white. All the store had is white. Certainly during COVID, during shortages, getting wire was really hard, and many of us had no choice. Put a wrap of black tape or a black or a wrap of red tape around the end of that wire so that the next person out there isn't caught off guard and can identify that, hey, this is probably a hot circuit here. It's not a neutral. It's not a ground. It's not a whatever. Blue and yellow, purple as well, those are commonly used for what I'll say is sometimes hot. It's not always hot. It's sometimes hot. What do you mean by that? Well, take a switch. Let's look inside your house. You got a circuit breaker in the mechanical room that feeds 110 volts down a black wire. There's a white common neutral wire running in there and a green, a ground wire as well. And it runs into your living room where you've got a light hanging from the ceiling. The white neutral and the green ground will essentially pass through the first, you know, your junction box, your switch box, if you will, and go straight to the light. But the hot wire, the black wire, will go to the line in on your switch. And then the line out of that switch is commonly, and better electricians will make this happen, done in a blue or yellow or a purple, indicating it's a switched leg. So you can imagine if you're opening up a electrical box in the house and you see four wires coming out of one conduit, a green, a white, a black, and a purple, blue, or yellow for the fourth. The black goes to the switch, and then the other blue, yellow, or purple goes to the switch. It's a clear way of indicating which one is the power coming into that switch and which one is the power going out of that switch, being the purple, blue, or yellow, to your load or to the light in that case. And again, the white and the green, it's not going through a switch. It's just carried right through that box, right to the appliance, to the light, to the load, whatever that load may be. So there are a number of things that we see done improperly that can be confusing when you're in the field and can actually cause some people who are maybe not paying attention for whatever reason. Maybe it's, you know, been a long day, been a long week, been a long summer. Maybe they got issues going on that sort of distract them a little bit. And when, you know, most of us will look at a green wire and go, oh, there's no power in that green wire, and be less cautious, or a white wire because it's a neutral. Same thing, be less cautious. But if that white wire is in a conduit with a black wire and somebody at some point in time changed the circuit from 110 to 220, so both those are hot, or just didn't have enough black wire to make two black wires to get that 230 volts over to the appliance, it's something that can catch us. The gray wires are something that basically are used in interchangeable with the white as a neutral. So again, we've got black, which is hot, red, which is hot. A white wire with a wrap of tape, black or red, around the end of it is an indication that that is a hot wire. Blue, yellow, purple, orange. Not sure what other colors are out there. I'm sure there's pink probably that you know might be used. Those are usually an indication that they're switched. It's the sometimes hot side of the switch. White or gray as neutral. And then a green or even a bare copper wire with no casing whatsoever in a conduit would be an indication that it's a ground. Now, bare copper wire on the outside of your equipment pad, as we talked about last week when we discussed NEC, would be your bond wire, which is not a ground wire. And hopefully you listened to last week and that made sense to you. If you didn't listen, maybe go back to the last week's episode and listen in on that. But a bond and a ground are two different purposes, two different functions. And a bare copper wire can be used as a, or is truly the only wire that's by code supposed to be used, a solid bare wire, number eight gauge wire for bond wire, for pool equipment, for the rails, for everything metal in the pool, for the equipotential bond around the pool itself. So we've got wire size, we've got circuit breakers, we've got wire colors. What else have we got with this? A couple of laws that I used to use all the time when I was out in the field, especially working on hot tubs. And I there are other applications, but for me, that was the one that I always had to think about a little bit. Ohm's law and Watt's law, which have to do with amperage and voltage and wattage and power and all this kind of stuff. And it's something that can help us determine wire size needs and things of that nature. So spas back in the day have had electric heating elements that were usually 6 kilowatt or 6,000 watt heaters. Now today they're much, much less. Hot tubs are more efficient. They're better insulated, all this kind of stuff. They're, you know, usually in a 4,000, maybe 4,500 watt kind of application. But back in the day, they were 6,000 watts. And those heating elements at 6,000 watts were having 230 volts applied to them. Well, with that, if you were to go out to a hot tub and find it not heating, one of the first things I would do is open the thing up and test for power at the heating element to see, do I have 230 volts there? Making sure that the heater is getting power. If it's not getting power, okay, there's something else before the heater that's causing the problem. I need to look further. But if the heater is getting power, the next thing I would do is pull my ammeter out and do an amperage test. Well, how many amps should I be getting on that heating element? Now, spas typically have data labels on them that rate the entire amperage draw of the entire unit. So you'll have a hot tub that say it's rated at a 50 amp draw. Well, that's not the heating element by itself. That's the sum of all of its components. So how do we know what that heating element, that's sort of a generic thing in a stainless steel pipe, or back in the day, they were even in PVC pipes, very large diameter. Hayward used to make a spa pack years ago, pneumatic switches and relays and four function stepping switches, Len Gordon type of equipment for those that are as old as me and remember that junk. And it would have a threaded heating element that went into a bushing into a PVC pipe that was probably 4 inch in diameter to keep the heat away from the PVC. Later, they, you know, migrated into using stainless, getting away from threaded heating elements to what are considered flow through heating elements and so forth. And now they've even kind of gone away from a lot of the manufacturers to a smaller circulating pump with low flow environments, and the heating elements are entirely different. But Ohm's law and Watt's law still apply either way. And essentially what Watt's law says is if you take the wattage of a component, divide it by the voltage that is applied to it to make it work, what you'll end up with is the amperage draw that you should be getting when that unit is running. So if we have that 6,000 watt heating element and we put 230 volts to it, we should be drawing about 26 amps on that heater. So my voltmeter said I got 230 volts to it, so it's not a problem with the controls or whatever sending power to the heater. Let me just drop my ammeter across one of those legs and see what do I have. And mostly what you're going to see is it's kind of an all or nothing. You're either going to see that you got 25, 26 amps being drawn, or you've got nothing. If you have 25, 26 amps being drawn, well, that heating element is heating, at least at that moment. Now, it doesn't mean it's not going to shut off for some reason later, and you got to further troubleshoot. But if you have 0 amps, that means there's no power being consumed by the heating element. And most common cause for that is that the heating element, just like an old filament light bulb, LEDs and all that are totally different now, but the filament in the element is broken and it's not continuous. There's no resistance, so there's no ability for it to create heat. And that's sort of the long and short of for Watt's law. Okay, well, not all of us work on hot tubs, right? But many of us do work on pool lights. And even though LED is what everything is today, and you can't sell any incandescent bulbs or fixtures anymore, there still are a lot of those fixtures out there. And you can use the same principle when you're checking a light without ever pulling the light out of the pool. Find the junction box. Open it up. See what kind of power you've got at the junction box, at least. Do I have 12 volts or 120 volts, depending on the application? If you were to have a 300-watt light bulb, you know, the old conventional light bulb, and you're running that at a 12, you know, you got a transformer, so it's a 12-volt circuit. Divide the 300 watts by 12 volts, and that means you should have 25 amps drawn through it. So you can do the same thing in the junction box. Put your voltmeter on it. Do I have 12 volts? So I've got 12 volts. All right, well, let's take a look at the amperage and just see what's going on with the amperage. You should have 25 amps. Now, with that, let's back up to the first thing I talked about, wire size and amperage. In either of those cases, a 6,000-watt spa heating element that's running 230 volts has drawn 26 amps, or a 300-watt light bulb in a pool running 12 volts, which has drawn 25 amps. What size wire do we need for that? Either of those applications are going to utilize the same size wire. Again, 14-gauge wire is only good for 15 amps, so that's not enough. We've got 25, 26 amps. That's not enough. 12-gauge wire will get us 20 amps. That's still not enough. We need to move to a 10-gauge wire, which is capable of handling 30 amps through it in order to have that circuit properly designed. And that's why when, you know, the old incandescent lights, you know, Pentair, again, I'm a big Pentair guy, their Amerilights had, when they were 12-volt Amerilights, they had an orange cord. And within that orange cord, the three wires that are inside that are 10-gauge wire. If it's 120 volt light, well, that same 300 watts divided by 120 is now only 2.5 amps. So that doesn't need 10 gauge wire. Even so, they would use, well, two things. One, the sheath on the outside of that cord is going to be black, not orange, indicating that it's high voltage. And two, the wires inside of it, they don't need to use 10 gauge wire. So they would go to a 12 gauge wire. Don't know why they didn't go to a 14, but I think it was always 12. Maybe I'm mistaken on that. Maybe they did a 14 in there. I don't know. But at any rate, the wire size was definitely smaller. So you didn't need to have, you know, as because you didn't have as much of an amperage draw to power that light. Today's LED lights draw next to nothing in terms of amperage. So they, you know, they can certainly get away with a much, much smaller wire size. And that's where we get into some of the nicheless lights, especially the smaller, like microbrights and such, that have increasingly smaller wire diameter. Because although the lumen output may be significant, the wattage that the amperage that light is drawing is way, way reduced. So a couple of applications of using Watt's law there with pool lights, older incandescent, not older, I mean, it's not that old, just a couple of years, incandescent lights, as well as the spa heater example. And then Ohm's law. So the same, let's go back to the same hot tub. In order for a heating element to heat, the element itself has to have resistance. Resistance is what creates heat. And Ohm's law can actually be something that can help us determine the what that resistance value should be. So if you were to walk up to a hot tub, the old 6,000 watt, 230 volt, and Watt's law says, basically, if I were to divide the voltage applied to the appliance by the amperage of that appliance, the result is the resistance value that device has. So if we were to take that 230 volt, 6,000 watt heating element, again, that heating element drawing somewhere around 26 amps, I'm sorry, you take the 230 volts and divide it by the 26 amps, and that's going to put us right around 9 ohms of resistance. Okay, so we can have another way of checking a heating element then in a hot tub. We go up to it, we can disconnect the, and critical, obviously you want to kill power to it. Disconnect the wires feeding power that should be feeding power to the heating element, and across the heating element connections, put your voltmeter to an ohm setting and test the resistance through that heating element. And in that type of a scenario, you should get somewhere around 10 ohms of resistance. So a few different tests that you can do. Yeah, and pool light too, the old incandescent lights, you could also check those from the deck box to see if the bulb is continuous or not, or if the fixture is continuous in there with the resistance test. Now you're not going to get, you're not looking for an exact value at that point because it's so low, but what you're looking more for is just a simple continuity test. And if you disconnect in the junction box and take your black and white wire that are running down to the light fixture and test for resistance between the two, you should have continuity between them. If you don't have continuity, it's not going to heat up to create the light that's generated, right? That light is created because of heat in the filament. And with no resistance there, it's an open circuit, probably a bad bulb. The bulb burnt out, could have a bad fixture, or just bad wires between the fixture and the junction box you're working from. But inevitably, the circuit's not complete. So a few different ways that you can check power in those types of things. Voltmeters, I know, we've talked about this in the past too when we've talked about electricity, but you can go out and spend a lot of money on a really nice Fluke, which is great, but you don't have to. If you're not working on electrical frequently, a lot of our technicians actually have voltmeters from Harbor Freight that are probably $10 today, maybe 12, maybe 15, that will get you everything you need. It'll get you volts. It'll get you resistance. And they also have Harbor Freight and those types of, economical tool shops have ammeters that are also relatively inexpensive. Now you can go get an ammeter that may be able to do everything for you. It'll do, you can do an amperage test. You can do voltage, you can do resistance, all three, and maybe an ammeter. If the voltmeter is $12, an ammeter might be $30 that does all three from one of those. Now, you don't expect it to last forever. It's not the highest quality. It's definitely not, you're going to have a little bit of issue, especially on the higher resistance values with the probes not being very, very high quality with things like that, that it's a Fluke is by far a better tool. But if you're only using it, I would argue once a week or even less frequently than that, it's a tool that if you're able to work on electric in the areas where you're at, certainly we don't want you doing something that you're not licensed to do or that you have to be licensed to do and you don't carry that license. But in our market, Chicago, we're able to work on electricity without that. Having a voltmeter with you is something that's maybe going to answer some questions that you wouldn't be able to answer otherwise. So anyway, I think that's a good sort of introductory thing on electricity for you after the week of after last week's NEC. And certainly, as always, if you have any questions, concerns, thoughts, comments, whatnot, please send them to us, talkingpools@gmail.com, and Rudy will forward it on to whoever the most appropriate person to answer it is. Make sure you're tuning in Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Listen to us all week long. I'm actively looking to get someone to jump back on here with me so you don't have to listen to my dull, boring voice every week by my own. Going to be out of town here for a few weeks traveling, and when I get back, we'll be looking at some great potential candidates to help me come spend a little bit of time with you every Tuesday. But until then, you're stuck with me. I hope you can tolerate my one-man show for a little bit longer. And other than that, we will talk to you again next week. Have a great week. Stay safe.
I just wanted to take a minute to say thank you for listening today. I'm hoping you enjoyed the episode as much as we enjoyed putting it together for you. Listen, it's been a couple of wacky, crazy, screwed up years from pandemic to Poolmageddon. I just want you to know that we are all in this together. If there's anything that we can do for you, send me an email at talkingpools@gmail.com. Again, that's talkingpools@gmail.com. We're here. This is your podcast. We are the Pool People's Podcast, of the pool people, for the pool people, by the pool people's body. Podcast. This one is about you. So thank you for tuning in and listening. Do me a favor, click subscribe before you go. That way you don't miss an episode.